From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guests this morning are Eric Miller, CEO, and Dana Kunz, Chief Operating Officer for Avion, which is a company that designs and builds simple Bluetooth controls for home automation. Once headquartered in California, Avion has now moved their company to Park City. And we look forward to our conversation with Eric and Dana, who are our in-studio guests.
Good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is Dr. Michael Osterholm, who has written a new book called Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. In today's world, it's easier than ever to move people, animals, and materials around the planet, but the same advances that make modern infrastructure so efficient have made epidemics and even pandemics inevitable. As outbreaks of Ebola, MERS, yellow fever, and Zika have demonstrated, we're not prepared to deal with the fallout. So what can we do in order to protect ourselves from mankind's deadliest enemy? Well, our guest will help us better understand this challenge.
I had trouble sleeping last night.
After,
you know, if you have trouble sleeping, you may not want to read this book. But anyway, there's a lot of good information in it. These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Eric Miller, CEO, and Dana Kunz, Chief Operating Officer for Avion. It's a company that designs and builds simple Bluetooth controls for home automation. In the past, words such as home automation used to be equated with expensive and hard to configure. Not so with a new wave of less expensive, easier to use Bluetooth-enabled products from companies like Avion. Eric and Dana, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning.
Thanks. Yeah. Great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. Maybe we can start with you, Eric, on smart home lighting. People do sort of think of that as expensive, hard to use. Can you take us through the value proposition of your products?
Sure. What Avion's really about, we founded it to change the way the world wires and controls spaces. Today, if you ever want to change where a light switch is located or change what lights it's connected to, it's an expensive, complicated digging up the walls, repainting, something that's almost, you know, something you don't even do because it's so difficult. Or if you go to a control system, you know, that would be tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars. What we've done is take what essentially ordinary embed Bluetooth radios and ordinary lights, ordinary switches, and get rid of the wires in the walls. And then you can change them just with your mobile phone. The products don't cost much more than just the regular switches and lights you would put in anyway. So essentially you can now do this with no higher cost for new devices and saving all that construction.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And you all gave me an outdoor smart switch, which I really appreciated for my holiday lights. And the outdoor receptacle that I have has a cover over. It's very difficult to stick, you know, the plugs in. So once I got yours in, which was pretty easy, I don't have to go outside anymore. I don't have to plug anything in. I don't have to mess with the cold. I don't have to. Just off my iPhone, I'm able to configure these and set up a schedule. And then, you know, this thing is basically taken over all winter, which is great.
Yeah, what we find sometimes people say, well, I don't know what I would do with that. And you say, do you ever have a light switch that's not where you want it to be or connected to a different light? Or do you ever want to put something on a schedule so that it runs itself and I don't want to have to go out in my yard and flip timers and stuff? That basically is what we do.
Okay, so as I said to you before we went on air, I found myself asking myself some what I thought were very naive, shall we say. I won't say dumb questions. This morning when I was looking at your site, and I guess it comes back to, you know, how does a wireless system connect to the grid, and what did Rocky Mountain Power have to say about your technology?
Oh, well, you know, the great thing about our system is it works just like your regular switches in the walls. And at the same time, you get the added benefit of replacing the wire, some of the control wires in the walls, with software and Bluetooth radios. So Rocky Mountain Power is excited about systems like ours because we can actually help you save energy. So there's lots, there's convenience and peace of mind, but controlling your systems and making sure in a town like Park City, your heat tape goes on and off in a consistent fashion, or your outdoor lights, because we all love our outdoor lights, come on at sunset and then go off at, say, 10 p.m. instead of running all night. That's a big savings for a community like Park City.
So is the savings, the energy savings, in the technology, or is it just in the ability to control more when things go on and off? Is there something about the technology that saves?
Yeah, it's actually in both places. When you're talking about a new home or a remodel or retrofit, you can actually do less construction and less destruction in the case of a remodel, where you just use wireless switches instead of adding control wires for multi-way switches. I don't know. I know John has a house that has a lot of multi-way switches in it, and maybe Lynn, you do too. Three and four way switches. Imagine if you didn't have to run the control wires for the second, third, and fourth switch in a great room. Another really awesome use of this is for accessibility and mobility. You know, here in Park City, we love the National Ability Center, and we enjoy working with all kinds of people and accessibility. So think about kids. A lot of kids are too short to hit the light switch. They get in trouble all the time for leaving the lights on in the bathroom. You can actually move the switch down without destroying the wall, so that while they're 2, 3, and 4, they can still reach the light switch. There's another interesting case, teenagers.
Who never turn off the lights.
So imagine if you have a wireless all-off switch in the garage. And so when they walk out the garage, they can hit one switch and the whole house goes dark.
Right. Or you're laying in bed and you say, I left that kitchen light on. And boom, you just knock it off.
Well, and you know, there's another really great use case there that is cutting edge, and that's using the Amazon Echo and voice control. In our house, we have Alexa in the kitchen. We have her in the bedroom. And so when I go to sleep and I look down the hall and I can see the lights still on in the kitchen, I go, Alexa, turn off the kitchen lights. And she does. And yeah. I don't have to make that big, long journey down to the kitchen to turn off the lights.
Right. Hey, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Eric Miller, CEO, and Dana Kunz, who's the Chief Operating Officer for Avion, real cool company here in Park City, designs and builds simple Bluetooth controls for home automation. Dana, you had an analogy that just makes so much sense to me, because I was in the networking business for a whole bunch of years, and that's that you can go into an office today and you can see a gigabit Ethernet plate, you know, the connection for Ethernet, and nothing's connected to it because we have evolved over a short period of time to a wireless world. It's the same type of thing that's going to be happening in the home space.
Yeah, absolutely. And lighting is a perfect place to do it, because you can use technology like ours to untether the light from the circuit. Can you imagine that? Mm-hmm. And untether the switch from the wall. So right. Now you have flexibility that you never even dream possible. It's what we call in the marketing world a blue ocean experience, meaning it's a market and it's an experience that we've never had before.
And we all understand that Bluetooth has certain restrictions, and it certainly works within a home. But let's say you go down to meet some friends in Salt Lake and you say, you know, I'm going to actually stay down here for dinner and I want to turn my outdoor lights on. How do you do this in a remote way?
So this is one of the cool things that's important to balance actually in the home is you want that cool accessibility when you're down the hill. You also still want your lights to work in the middle of the night in the middle of a storm when the internet's down. Really critical with lighting. And it's a safety thing. So our technology has this nice balance where the switches and the lights actually all talk to each other inside the house and don't need any kind of internet connection to keep working. But you can add a little brick. It's about, it looks like about the size of a power adapter in your wall. You set it up to your Wi-Fi, and then that gives you remote control to anywhere in the world using your phone, Amazon Alexa, web pages, anything else. So we've kind of balanced a good balance of local independent controls, because a lot of the other control systems out there, if the internet goes down, your lights don't work. And that's really just not acceptable. And so we kind of do a nice balance of those two in a very kind of low overhead way. And that's really probably the biggest innovation we've brought to the whole controls market, is getting those two things to work together.
I'm kind of stuck on something you said, Dana, and maybe Eric, you can talk a little bit about this. You know, I always think about energy savings, and we tend to leave things plugged into the wall. Our, many of our devices, our printers, or, you know, well, many devices, I don't need to name them. I know we all do it. So that draws a little energy, a little electricity, they say, and I've never measured it in my own house, but a wireless system wouldn't draw down on any electricity. Is that right?
Not much. One thing, let me give you a little bit about my background. I actually have been in the energy efficiency business and helped write and actually advocate for a lot of the energy efficiency policies kind of nationwide for my whole career. So I know something about this.
Yeah.
There's really two ways to save energy. One is to make the device itself use less when you use it. And that's the focus on efficient air conditioning, heating. LED lights are huge. Anybody out there that hasn't replaced their incandescent lights with LEDs, go do it. You'll save 95% of your energy use right there. Energy Star is all about, on things like printers, it's all about getting the standby power very low so you're not wasting energy when you're not using things. The other way is when you're using energy, because you do want lights. I mean, we need lights. We're going to use it when you need it. And that's really where the control side. So we're really part. Mm-hmm. LEDs give us that very efficient, most efficient possible lighting, so you're not wasting energy in the light itself. The controls allow you to use the lights only when you need them and only to the extent you need them. And that's the other piece of the puzzle.
And Eric, there's another piece of that puzzle too, is using it only when you need it at the level you need it, right? So dimming is a really big part of saving energy. Tell us a little more about that part.
Well, a lot of lights, like when we went the whole, what we call sort of the nightmare phase of the compact fluorescent, those, you know, mm-hmm. screw plug, they're terrible lights. I mean, the light quality's terrible. They don't dim. So a lot of people just let them run all the time because they weren't good at dimming. And in the end, they have a lot of toxic materials. They weren't that efficient. They actually didn't save that much.
They didn't last either.
just a terrible, terrible solution. LEDs are like a perfect technology. They dim down to nothing. They're almost as efficient as scientifically possible. The prices are coming down. You can tune the quality of the light, the color of the light. It's really kind of a perfect technology. And it's sort of, we're in this cool phase where we're going to bring lighting, where lighting can do anything we want it to do without it being really expensive in either energy or controls.
So is it simple to get the new wireless, say, bathroom switch off of, to make that change, to make it adapt for, as you said, if you have young children and you want to have a lower switch, how do you make the switch?
So it's really easy. You can take your existing in-wall switch, swap it with an Avion in-wall switch, and those are available either from Avion or from, they're GE branded, they're out there at Home Depot. And then you add an Avion movable switch, which is a wireless one, and you can just stick it on the wall with tape. We have the command strips that are movable tape, or you can actually use the screws and adhere it to the wall that way. So you can do it as a DIY home project, or if you would like to have your electrician swap out the in-wall switch, you can do it that way.
There's also part of our overall business is a lot of leading companies are bringing out products built with Avion technology in from the beginning. And so you'll start seeing a whole range of light bulbs, in-ceiling fixtures, all kinds of track lights. There'll be a whole range. You can pretty much any light in your house is going to be able to come Avion enabled already, and you just screw it in and plug it in, and you're all ready to go.
I want to go back to something we were speaking about earlier, just to make sure we make the point, and that's on a new build, new construction. There's labor involved in pulling wire, and there's also cost involved in buying copper wires. Mm-hmm. So on, if you have a lot of five-way switches and you're pulling five pairs of wires to one location, you're doing that a bunch of times, you will save money on labor and on copper on a new build. I'm not sure what that would be. Maybe you could help us quantify that. But
the control wiring in a building can be about 50% of the wiring, the total wiring. Mm-hmm. So if you did sort of a 100% Avion build from scratch, you could probably save upwards of 50%, possibly even more in the total wiring and all the labor and a lot of the labor that goes with that.
Dana, we were speaking in the green room before the show began, and we were talking about new dimming strategies and technologies to be able to follow the wavelengths of the sun, the natural sun. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this is an exciting development in consumer lighting, and it's called tunable white. If you go into one of the big box stores now, into the LED section, they'll have you put your hand in a box, and you can look at different colors. There's warm and cool and in between. And essentially, it mimics the movement of the sun and the natural light. Here in Cool Science Radio, we're having it's fairly cool lighting at the moment because we have morning light, and later in the afternoon it probably gets kind of warm and it feels a little golden in here, right? Well, you can actually have that same experience in your home or office with tunable white. And so we're at the leading edge of bringing that kind of a changeable lighting experience into both office buildings as well as homes.
Great. So I'm curious about why you moved the company here. You were in Northern California.
Yeah, we've been in the Bay Area for a long time, done a number of technology companies in there, and a couple of things. It's getting kind of nutty there. Things are really expensive. It's hard to hire people. The commuting, the efficiency, it's kind of becoming a very inefficient place to work. We'd always, on a personal level, love the lifestyle and like being in the mountains, and so we had a desire ourselves. And Park City was sort of a perfect place. We wanted to be near an airport where we could get anywhere in the world because we work with companies literally all over the world where products of ours are coming out in Australia and all over the place. And if you look at sort of a place with a good technology base and actually a really talented labor pool, University of Utah, other places near an airport, Park City is pretty unique and ideal spot.
So no doubt it wasn't just Park City that you looked at, or was it?
We certainly looked, you know, we looked at Portland, we looked at New York,
London, Paris.
We looked actually all over the world because we could kind of take this anywhere. And, you know, we really liked the culture and the environment here and the talent base. It all kind of came together here. Cost of living is actually, coming from California, it's pretty attractive. So it's not cheap here, but better than others and better than some other places.
I could make it even a little more local. You can walk your dogs here.
Yeah, you sure can. You sure can.
You can bring your dog to the radio show. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's an awesome dog here in the studio with us. So everybody just say a shout out to Jack.
Yeah. Jack's taking a snooze right now. Oh, boy. I wanted to ask you about something that I've been thinking about. When I built my house several years ago, I'm sort of a audiovisual nut. So I've got a lot of TVs. I have a lot of Sonos stations, a lot of Sonos receivers for the various rooms of my house. And I was concerned about my utility bill, about being able to, you know, these devices are on and they're pulling watts and things like that. And my AV guy said, no, when they're not on, they don't pull watts and that sort of thing. And I had a pretty high electric bill. So I looked into it and he wasn't correct in what he said. For an example, my DirecTV receiver, and I've got a bunch of those receivers, when they are on and your TV is on, you're pulling so many watts, and you pull like 10 less watts per hour when it's off. I mean, it's just gobbling up electricity in the off mode. Are there any products out there that will help us with that?
There's progress being made. I mean, that's been, I would say, that the whole Energy Star program, EPA's Energy Star program, has really been about attacking that, you know, and I think they've done a really good job of being very aggressive at pushing manufacturers and creating ratings and standards to force them to have standby modes and be careful, you know, tune down the power usage when necessary, because the audio visual equipment is a really bad actor in that regard. They tend to not care much about it, and they just leave it all on. And it does, as you found, it does use a lot of power. So if I talk about, for example, in lighting, energy, the ratings now are requiring lower and lower off state power and getting very, very low. And it's actually one of the interesting things for our technology is Bluetooth is actually the only radio that has low enough energy consumption to meet that these next upcoming standards. A lot of the other systems don't. There, I would say, look for Energy Star, especially Energy Star 2.0. Energy Star 2.0 stuff, they've really started to dig into the problem that you had. The Energy Star 1.0, the manufacturers like the DirecTVs, they're low in off mode, but they're never off because they're always connected, So they don't actually ever turn off. And Energy Star 2.0 has gotten more aggressive about saying, hey, you can't just leave it on all the time. You've got to actually look minute by minute at what power levels. And, that would be my best suggestion is look for Energy Star 2.0.
Okay, because products. DirecTV is like 95% of its online. Its offline is 95%
exactly.
consumption of its on. So it's just crazy. I think one of the other things is that they have plugs that you plug in that are wirelessly enabled so that you can, and maybe that's an Avion product you
Absolutely.
Could use, so that you've got a wiring closet downstairs and somebody wants to watch TV downstairs, so you enable that plug and now you've got juice flowing. Now, the problem is the TV and the receiver have to configure themselves, so there's a wait there, and that's why we can get some more help from them if they were able to address that.
Right, you can always use an Avion plug-in switch to be able to put it on a schedule. For example, if you always watch TV in the evening and you don't use the TV at any other time of the day, and you just do have to allow that time for it to wake itself up and
right.
all the pieces to reconfigure themselves.
As much as John here is an audiovisual nut on the spectrum, I would be equal parts on the other side of the spectrum. I don't even own a remote control.
You and me.
I'm happy to hear that. And you work in this technology.
It's a brave new world, Lynn. We're going to have to bring you there.
I know. But for someone like me, where does Avion technology fit in to your lives? And I'm thinking already two places, heat tape and exterior lights.
Yeah, and so you are our target market. We know John's an early adopter.
Right.
And John is what we call, he likes to be the IT manager of his home.
I do.
You're so important.
No, it's just I love those challenges.
Yeah, good. Okay.
And he doesn't mind rebooting six times to get to the end result. And Eric's sort of in that category too. At our house we do have four remote controls on the coffee table. And the way I turn on the TV is I go, Eric, would you turn on the TV? And so we have voice control in addition to Alexa at our house. And so the great thing about Avion technology is it's set it and forget it. So when you put our light switches and plugins into your house, and once we've used the app to configure, you can put the app down and you never have to pick up your phone again until you want to reconfigure the system. And so we know that people just want to use the switches on the walls, or in our case, the movable switch on the coffee table to access the lighting system. Does that sound like what you're talking mm-hmm. about?
Yeah.
And actually, sure. this winter, I swapped our switches on our heat tape, and it's been phenomenal because I think, as we all know, there's just about a three-hour window in any particular day where the heat tape even is effective. I mean, running it when it's 10 below out doesn't do any good, and so being able to pay attention to how right now I can really knock the snow down, and I can do it with just a few hours running them, and I might be at work and I can just pull up my app and say, right now, and I turn it on for that time window, and otherwise I don't.
And then it goes off automatically, doesn't it, Eric?
Yeah, and it'll just then turn itself off automatically. And
I think that is so key. I mean, my energy bill is three times the amount per month when I just turn on the heat tape, and I don't know when it's most efficient. When is it most efficient? You said like a temperature range or a time in the
day.
What
I find is around 20 to 35, sort of when you've still got big snow buildup, and it's going to be there, but it's still cold enough that it's not going to go away by itself. Below about 20 or 15, everything's frozen solid. I mean, your little wire is not going to do much, and you're just heating up the great outdoors. So if you kind of get that, what I found, at least personally, is you get a window in kind of the 20s to 30s, then you get a lot. Then even like 3 or 4 hours will really make a huge difference. And I can do it just like one day or a couple of days instead of every day. So yeah, my bill this year, and this year was obviously a much bigger year than last year, was about a third of what it was last year. So it was saved hundreds of dollars. I mean, it paid for itself in a month.
That's impressive.
Plus, Lynn, when you pull into your house, let's say you have it on the side that your garage is, and you look up and you see the accordion pattern of the heat tape, and everything's melted around there because we haven't had snow in 10 days or 12 days or something like that, then you would definitely turn it off because it's not adding any value at this point.
Right.
So you know, turn it off completely. And I wanted to mention it's very unusual for us to have an in-studio guest because, you know, we're talking to people from outside of Park City typically, although sometimes in Park City. So here's an opportunity. We have lots of people that are listening in this morning. Do you have any employment opportunities? You are currently on Rasmussen Drive. What are you looking for?
We're looking for product leaders and mechanical engineers and electrical engineers. We do all of our hardware integration and testing here in Park City. We are also always looking for marketing leaders, so people who really understand digital.
Okay, and how would they get in touch with you?
They can go to avion.com. They can call me, 415-987-9798. I'm happy to put my phone number out there
sure.
if you're interested in that. And also by email. We're available in all those modes of communication.
And just want to mention your website is, and your company name is Avion, AVI-ON.com.
Correct.
Well, this has been interesting.
This is great.
Yeah. Oh, I got to see you configuring your heat tape. This is going to be awesome.
We'll get you going for next year, Lynn.
Okay.
Eric Miller, CEO, and Dana Kunz, Chief Operating Officer for Avion. They design and build simple Bluetooth controls for home automation. This is just the beginning. They're going to have a whole bunch of follow-on products. You can currently get their products under the GE name or Avion name at Home Depot. And Dana, where else?
Well, avion.com, and actually almost all the big box stores nationally carry the GE-branded products that are powered by Avion.
All right, great. Listen, thanks for joining us.
So great to have you. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
When we return, Rhett, we're going to have a conversation with Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's written Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Eric Miller, the CEO, and Dana Kunz, Chief Operating Officer for Avion, a company that designs and builds simple Bluetooth controls for home automation based right here in Park City. Really impressive. And our next guest is Dr. Michael Osterholm, who has co-written, along with Mark Olshocker, the book Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. Unlike natural disasters, whose destruction is concentrated in a limited area over a period of days, and illnesses which have devastating effects but are limited to individuals and their families, infectious disease has the terrifying power to disrupt everyday life on a global scale. Michael Osterholm, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, as John was saying to me this morning, he was reading your book last night, and it made it a little difficult to sleep. and I think it's ubiquitous, the concern, especially once you start reading about Ebola and Zika virus, and it's a bit overwhelming. Is that because we don't realize the crisis, or is it because, well, infectious disease is just a pretty scary thing?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of all of those things. In the first instance, you know, that which we don't know much about tends to scare us when we hear about it. I mean, a good example was the public health community was not overly concerned about Ebola spreading in the United States when it was occurring in West Africa, whereas the public was very concerned. And so what we try to do in Deadliest Enemy is actually take kind of fact from fiction, and we look very carefully at those things which scare us, those things which concern us, those things which hurt us, and those things which can kill us, and they're sometimes very different. What we've really concentrated on is the fact that we live in this modern world where we've eliminated oceans and mountain ranges and political boundaries in terms of the spread of microbes around the world today that can kill us. And what our job is to try to lay out a very effective plan that says if we do these few things, we can really minimize the impact that these diseases would have, because some of them could be absolutely catastrophic, like pandemic influenza or antibiotic resistance.
Right. Well, there's so many things to talk about here, and I don't really know where to start. So I'm going to start with Ebola. And I'm wondering, when Ebola first broke out, I want to say in the early 1990s is when I remember hearing about the pandemic for the first time. It seemed like it was going to gobble up not only the African continent, but then as soon as it, you know, got on an airplane and made its way to the U.S., then it seemed to decline, and every so often you see it raising its head again. Talk about this pandemic.
Yeah. Well, actually, Ebola is a good example. It's a disease that we actually call epidemic because it occurs in regional areas. A pandemic is something that occurs around the entire world, and there are very few diseases that can actually have that happen where it spreads around the entire world. But Ebola is a viral infection that comes from animals in Africa, particularly in the jungle areas of Africa. And its natural home is likely in bats, and then they may in turn come in contact with monkeys and other subhuman primates. And in turn, humans come in contact with them, hunting and so forth, and that's when it spills over into humans. In the past, there had only been 20-some outbreaks of Ebola in all of since we've learned about it in the 1970s, of which it included about 2,200 cases. And what they, a typical outbreak would be in a very small rural village, sometimes 2 days' walk from the nearest road, and it was spread by contact with infected body fluids, blood, vomit, and so forth, and it would never spread beyond that little village. And so it was not a big challenge in terms of stopping it. But what happened was, and this is what is true throughout many of the issues we deal with in our book, is the fact that the world's changed. Today, one of the fastest-growing regions for human population in the world is in Central Africa. The urbanization of Africa has also resulted in cities like Kinshasa and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where today they have 14 million people, of which 6 million people live in the worst conditions imaginable in the slums of Kinshasa. These people are packed together. Now, when Ebola virus should make it into there, it's a very different situation, and that's exactly what happened in West Africa. So our message is that that's going to continue to be a big challenge there. It's not going to spread around the world in a way that would concern us here in the United States, for example, but nonetheless, we need vaccines that would be effective in making Africa what we call Ebola prepared. If we vaccinated healthcare workers and burial team members and emergency responders right now with an effective vaccine, which we don't have yet, that's licensed, we could take Ebola literally off the table as a major crisis. That's an example we use in the book and tell about how we could actually make that happen.
There are a lot of exciting examples in your book, and one of them, Dr. Osterholm, is the dengue virus. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but it's the same mosquito. It's in the same region as the Zika virus, and it's killed more people, but I've never heard of it before. How did Zika get such prominence?
Well, you know, this is another good example of the modern world conditions we're talking about in the book. Actually, the mosquito that transmits dengue, transmits a disease called chikungunya, transmits Zika, and transmits yellow fever, a concern we have right now in Brazil with yellow fever too, is called Aedes aegypti. Aedes aegypti is a native of Africa. It came over in the first slave ships to the Americas and took hold. It's a mosquito that breeds basically in very closed areas, kind of little water container areas out of the main sun and so forth. It's not the swamp mosquito. It's not the mosquito you think of in jungles. And By the 1930s, this mosquito was in a number of locations in the Americas, and then at that time, the Rockefeller Foundation, along with the Panamanian Health Organization, decided we're going to eradicate this. We're going to get rid of it. We're going to find all the breeding sites and so forth. And by the 1970s, it was almost completely gone out of the Americas. But we didn't finish the job. And today, with the advent of plastic garbage in the modern world, which is an ideal place for this to breed, one little bottle cap in a ditch can be a very effective place for these mosquitoes to breed if it gets water in it from rainfall. And the problem we have today is now this mosquito is widespread through the Americas, including South America, Central America, the Caribbean, and even parts of the southern United States, more than it's ever been in the history of humankind. So now when a new virus comes in, like dengue virus or Zika or so forth, it spreads very quickly. The point you asked about dengue, dengue is a very serious disease, killing many more people than Zika, and it's another interesting phenomenon. There was four different types of dengue virus, and they were all isolated to different parts of the world till World War II, and then we started moving mosquitoes around the world in all of our shipment of goods and so forth, and now all four strains of dengue virus are everywhere that dengue is. And the problem with that is, in the old days, if you got infected with a dengue strain, you got what we call breakbone fever. You got better after you felt like you're going to die, but you didn't. Now, today, people do die because if you get infected with the second strain of dengue virus, you get what we call dengue hemorrhagic fever, and that one can be fatal. And so it's an example of dengue hemorrhagic fever didn't exist until literally 20 to 30 years ago through much of the world, and that's what's happened with Zika and so forth. The way Zika is a real problem is, of course, it affects young children, newborns. And, you know, seeing a child born with this very small head with severe neurologic deficit is obviously heart-tugging to all of us. But if you actually look at the impact of Zika, it's not nearly as great as dengue is right now.
Mm-hmm. I was also fascinated, Dr. Osterholm, about your conversation about HIV-infected population. 60% are not being treated, which means that of the 37 million that have it, 15 million are being treated, 22 million people aren't. So that was a real
right.
eye-opener to me, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to make some quick phone calls. That surprised me. I called five of my friends, and I said, tell me what you think about AIDS and how we're doing with it. And everyone said, case closed. We got it under control. Done deal. And in fact, it's not, and it's having sort of a, not pandemic, epidemic in Southeast Asia right now. There's a resurgence of of HIV and AIDS. So can you talk about that? I mean, we're all under the impression that we took care of this.
Well, you know, this has actually been one of the good news, bad news situations. It has been where, in fact, under President Bush, the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Response to Basically AIDS program, has been an absolute godsend to the world in terms of preventing or treating HIV. And we have supplied drugs to much of Africa. And what's happened, unfortunately, is as much as we've provided, the number of new cases has outstripped our ability to treat people. But we today have millions of people under treatment because of PEPFAR. I only point that out to you because we're all sitting today on bated breath because it looks like right now the major cuts that the president has just announced are going to hit really hard into the State Department and public health and the areas that we're talking about. So if we think we had a challenge already with HIV/AIDS, I can tell you right now that challenge may have grown dramatically with the budget announcement today. And, you know, as the old oil fram commercial of many years ago once said, you know, you pay me now or you'll pay me later. And the bottom line is if we don't do a better job of controlling these diseases, they cost us much more later down the road. And so here's an example. I'm not sure how effective our work is going to be with HIV in the next upcoming years if, in fact, the president's budget goes through as it looks like it is going to.
That's very disheartening. How about the lobby for people doing the kind of work that you're doing? Is it strong?
Well, we don't really have a lobby because it's really about the general public as such. I mean, we have the pharmaceutical company lobbies and we have, you know, the medical community lobbies. But what we do is really the merging of policy and public health science. And that's what we really hit hard on in Deadliest Enemy, is why those two are so important. It's not enough to have a great scientific finding, and it's not enough just to have policy, which isn't informed by the science. It's really bringing the two together. And that's when you get the kind of changes that we think. For example, the 1940s flu vaccine that we still currently use, and I say 1940s because the technology hasn't changed much. Today, we now have data which supports that we could create new vaccines that could be highly effective against many strains of influenza at the same time and could potentially last for many, many years. So you get vaccinated once. That would not only reduce our problems with seasonal flu, but it would also take off the table the risk of a major worldwide pandemic if we sufficiently vaccinated the world. Now, imagine if a meteorologist today could say to you, you know, I'm not just going to warn you about a hurricane that's coming, but I can actually make that hurricane go away. Wouldn't that be an amazing scientific achievement? So why haven't we done better with flu vaccines? Because nobody has put that as a priority. Last year, we spent over $1 billion working on HIV vaccines, which is a good thing to do, $1 billion. And are we close to an HIV vaccine? We still have a long ways to go. But last year, we only spent $35 million globally doing research on new flu vaccines, which could be a game changer for the world. And so our group, like the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy I'm at the university, we lobby for the public on that behalf. And, you know, people ask me why I wrote a book like this or, you know, why do I do what I do? You know, I've been in this business for 40-some years, and, you know, it's no longer about salaries or titles or whatever. But, you know, I keep thinking about what kind of world am we leaving my kids and grandkids? Mm. And every baby boomer in the United States, they should think about that. What are we doing for our kids? Are we going to leave them with a pandemic legacy? Are we going to leave them with antibiotic resistance? And that, to me, is what I think this book is really all about, and that's why we hope people look at it, read it, and help us change the future as opposed to having to live it.
Our guest is Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's the founding director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He's an internationally renowned epidemiologist, and he's been at the forefront of public health preparedness. He's led many outbreak investigations of international importance. He's written a new book, he's co-written it, called Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. And I want to talk a little bit about antibiotic resistance. We know and we are guided by our healthcare professionals, maybe mostly in the last, 8-10 years, about not overdoing it on the antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And they're very, very much less likely to prescribe antibiotics. I'm assuming for that reason, but talk about that if you would.
Well, actually, there are several good reasons that come to play. Let me just take kind of one that we don't think about. But, you know, our body is really a home for an amazing collection of microbes. There are more microbes in our body than there are cells. That includes the microbes that are in our gut, that are on our skin and so forth. And many of those are not only really important in terms of just being there and keeping the bad ones out, but they perform invaluable functions. I mean, we couldn't digest our food without these bacteria. And whenever we use an antibiotic, we actually upset that balance because it not only kills off the bad ones that are hurting us, but it also often kills the good ones too. So, you know, you don't want to use antibiotics any more than you have to, any more than you'd want to take a cancer drug if you don't have cancer. You know, why do it? And so that's one reason why, that we want to keep this naturally occurring microbial flora, as we call it, present as is. But the second thing is then what happens is bacteria basically reproduce minimum every 20 minutes. And every time one of them reproduces, they don't always necessarily reproduce themselves exactly with the same genetic material. There may be flaws in that material, and some of that is what we call mutations. And some of those mutations mean that the bacteria is never going to survive. It's just made defective and it dies. But some of those mutations, just by chance, are things like how to get around the antibiotic that's killing you. And so that they actually disarm that part of the antibiotic in the sense coming into the microbe. And so imagine humans where we have genetic recombination, you might say, or changes occurring once every generation, every 20 years. Bacteria do that every 20 minutes. And so the genetic roulette table favors them. And so we don't want to use any more antibiotic than we have to because it just pressures these bugs to get to be more resistant. Now, that's a challenge because today we often think of, well, let's just deal with these infections because I want something. And it's not just in humans. It's in animals, too. And so we have to get away from using antibiotics when they're not clinically indicated, even if we think it's something that's going to make us feel better.
Exactly. Dr. Osterholm, let's talk about climate change and what the and what some of the challenges will be for the future. I know that, for an example, we live at 7,000 feet above sea level here in Park City. And if there's a mosquito up here, it's because they hitched a ride on a car coming up from the airport from Salt Lake. But we don't have the water for it, and we don't have the temperature, but we have other things that are happening. You know, rattlesnakes weren't here 5 years ago, but they're at 7,000 feet now. And things are changing. Talk about infectious disease, about germs and mosquitoes and climate change.
Well, first of all, let me just make one editorial comment. Living in Minneapolis, I love where I live, but Park City is one of my most favorite places in the world. It's beautiful.
Great.
I've been there, and I'm coming back this summer, so I'll be there. But you've raised a very important point. And let me just illustrate how history it bears on this and what's happening with climate change. For reasons people didn't completely understood, but they at least could see what was happening, they established many of the major cities of the world, particularly in the mosquito belt, where diseases like yellow fever were very prominent, in some cases malaria. And they realized, you know what, if our city was at higher than so many feet above sea level, we just never seemed to get these diseases. But if we were down in the valley, we did. And so if you look at many of the major cities of the world that are in the region where these diseases occur, they were just what you said, out of that band of elevations where the mosquitoes were present that caused diseases. With climate change, we are seeing exactly what you just mentioned, is the fact that we are now seeing the range of these mosquitoes expand, both in terms of elevation to higher elevations, but also farther north or south, depending which side of the equator you're on. And so this is a huge challenge. In addition, precipitation patterns are changing. Instead of having, in some cases, an average rainfall of X, you may have X or a little bit more, but it occurs in two storms all year, as opposed to, you know, several, you know, many storms over the year. And so precipitation patterns are changing, which also can favor certain mosquito populations. So we have to anticipate this. The final piece is there's a thing called the extrinsic incubation period. Big word. But if a mosquito takes a blood meal on someone who's infected, for example, with malaria, and then they have to become infected themselves before they can transmit to somebody else. And that takes time. But the higher the average temperature is, the shorter the time is. So instead of a mosquito taking 8 to 10 days to become infected and then taking another blood meal, transmits that parasite onto somebody else, what if that happens in 3 or 4 days? You just greatly accelerate the speed with which the transmission can occur. And we're seeing that happen now, where we have mosquitoes that, you know, lived once at a mean temperature of 78.9 are now living at a mean temperature of 82, and that has tremendous implications for the speed at which these diseases can be spread. So climate change is a very important part of the future of infectious diseases, and one of our challenges is getting people just to believe climate change and to make sure that they understand that this is going to have a big impact on infectious diseases.
And that case you just mentioned of one person, if you did a probability analysis of 50 million people where that time has brought down significantly, there's all sorts of things could happen.
Absolutely. You're right on the mark. And that's what people don't understand, is when you add that all together, you know, like in a large metropolitan area like Bangkok, we have done the studies to look at this. It would greatly accelerate and speed up and actually make a much worse problem with diseases like malaria, for example, or dengue and some of these diseases in populations like that. So, yeah, it's not just the one person, it's the whole population. And then that just, it's faster and faster and faster. It's kind of like a calculus problem. The more people that get infected, the more mosquitoes get infected. The more mosquitoes get infected, the more people. And so it really becomes a real challenge. That's what we have to attack today.
And hand in hand with climate change, we will also have rising seawaters. So we will not only have mosquitoes migrating, we will have people migrating. And when you get more people in smaller spaces, when you have less potable water, when this happens, when that happens, I mean, there are a number of challenges with climate change, aren't there?
Absolutely. And, you know, can I just say one thing? It sounds like you could have helped write this book. You really get this. And
well,
this is exactly the compounding issues we're trying to deal with.
Yeah.
What we're trying to say is we can deal with these. We can't change climate change in the sense of the rising seawaters or the temperatures, but we in infectious disease work can do a lot to anticipate that and then try to do the things with vaccines and so forth that will help stop that situation from getting worse.
The book is Deadliest Enemy, and our guest is Dr. Michael Osterholm. And Dr. Osterholm, I just have to ask you this. So interesting. You know, we've talked Zika and Ebola and HIV, dengue, and antibiotic resistance. You start your book with a chapter on toxic shock syndrome. Now, that's something I have not heard about for a really long time.
Well, you know, this was an example, again, of where all the unfortunate conditions came together to make for a very bad situation. I was very involved with toxic shock syndrome, as were some of my colleagues in Utah. And what we found back in 1980 was the convergence of, first of all, a new strain of Staph aureus bacteria that produced a toxin that was what ultimately resulted in so many people developing toxic shock syndrome, and unfortunately, far too many of them dying. And it turned out that this particular bacteria needed to have a lot of oxygen present because that was the driver of making this toxin. So once there was more oxygen present around the bacteria, the greater the toxin production. Well, what happened was it coincided at the same time that the tampon industry greatly increased the fluid capacity of a tampon. These were all basically paper-based companies that had worked with disposable diapers and so forth, and they came up with these new products called superabsorbers, meaning chemical structures that could hold 20 to 30 times their weight in fluid. But in doing that, what they did is they gave off oxygen. Air basically escaped as the fluid was absorbed. Well, women at the time, of course, concerned about tampon accidents, thought the more highly absorbent tampons were the best thing that they could do. And so there was this major move forward to buy those tampons, not realizing that these superabsorbers, when in the vagina, which basically is an anaerobic environment, no oxygen, these introduced a great deal of oxygen there. And when the bacteria was present, no oxygen, it didn't make toxin. But when these tampons were used, suddenly with the oxygen change, it made all kinds of toxin. And so it was both Mother Nature in the sense of the presence of this bacteria, and it was the fact that now we had these superabsorber materials. And our studies were ones that first confirmed that. And once we did, the tampon industry greatly reduced the fluid capacity back to where it was before, and toxic shock syndrome cases dropped dramatically. And so this is an example of kind of unintended consequences of what people did, not ever thinking that a product like Rely brand tampons with such a name could also be the same product that could lead to a much higher risk of developing toxic shock syndrome.
Right. Really interesting chapter on that. Well, we've got to let you go. It's a fascinating book. Dr. Michael Osterholm is our guest.
Thank you.
He's co-written the book with Mark Olshocker. The book is Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. And I just have to say, it's really a privilege to be on a show like this where you have such informed individuals asking the questions.
Oh, thank you. And thank you. We want to invite you to be our guest in person this summer, if you would like to join us. We're on Thursday
mornings. I would
mornings.
Be happy to, and I'm in Park City. I'd love to do that. I'm coming for a wedding, and I can't wait to come. So I'll be in contact with you, okay?
Excellent.
Sounds great.
Excellent. Thank you again for writing the book.
Okay, thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye. And it's Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after these words.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. I want to thank our underwriter, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Davidson Orthopedics, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. Stay tuned now for national news from NPR.